This is Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated on the BizTalk Radio Network. The college admissions bribery scandal and what's the right way to seek help with the college admissions process. That's tonight on Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Andy Greenspan, Director of College Counseling for International College Counselors, aids families in navigating the college admissions process without paying bribes, I might add. In the education field, Andy has consulted with over 30 schools, including Princeton, Yale, University of Chicago, Duke, Carleton, Smith College, and Choate Rosemary Hall, helping their outreach to applicants. Prior to joining ICC, Andy spent his professional life interviewing, writing, and communicating for television, secondary schools, and colleges. For his work as a journalist, Andy's received broadcast journalism's most prestigious national honors, the DuPont Columbia, the Emmy, George Foster Peabody Awards, graduated from Columbia University, master's from Northwestern in journalism, and we were also classmates at Choate, so it's a particular honor to have him on here, and I can attest to his ethics, too. And honored also to be joined by Ted O'Neill. He was the Dean of Admissions at the University of Chicago for 20 years. Most recently, he was the head of admissions at Bard College Berlin, embarking on what he calls the best next stage for my life. He will become a full-time teacher, researcher, and writer at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Ted and Andy. Great to have you here.
Good to be here, Jamie, and thanks for revealing our boarding school background.
Hey, yeah, it's great to have you. And by the way, I want to get to Ted first, but before we do that, what did you win Emmy and Peabody's for?
The Emmy was for a piece about a mercenary with CIA ties. The Peabody was on home health care, and the DuPont Columbia was for freeing a wrongfully convicted man from prison.
Impressive. Okay, we're going to start with Ted. I want to hear, Ted, how surprised were you by this scandal, and is Chicago immune from this kind of a scandal threat?
How surprised? Well, I was very surprised. That may seem naive, but maybe it was the scope of it or the celebrity of it, but I think it was the audacity of it. I think have had various reasons for being suspicious about independent counseling, even though some of our best friends are independent counselors, and many of us become independent counselors. But those suspicions never extended to this kind of criminality. I was very surprised. Is Chicago susceptible? I think any place is susceptible. They seem to be very cagey about what they did. We, of course, didn't have the sports that were violated, that we don't have, the minor sports, the so-called country club sports. And we probably weren't quite as susceptible on the grounds of legacy and development connections, probably not quite as susceptible. So, but susceptible. We could be fooled. We're not policemen.
All right. Andy, give us sort of the brief overview and the current status of the scandal. And I'll tell you something. I happen to be interviewing a lawyer this week who was friends with the U.S. Assistant attorney from the Southern District that's on this case, which involves racketeering, money laundering, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. And he got the impression that they are set on making these folks serve some time in prison. Go ahead, Andy. Give us an overview.
Well, 50 people have been indicted, and a number have pled guilty, including Felicity Huffman, the actress, who is charged and has now pled guilty to paying, I believe, $15,000 to have her daughter's test scores made considerably better. Her daughter's scores went from about 1,000, I think, on the PSAT to about 1,400 on the SAT. A test taker went in and changed her, I believe, changed the answers of Felicity Huffman's daughter. On the other hand, people such as Lori Loughlin, another sort of the second celebrity in this case, are just sort of blithely going into court and refusing to plead guilty. And the feds have upped the ante with additional charges. And she could be looking at significant jail time, as could others who have thus far refused to admit their guilt.
Did you know of this Bill Singer guy, consultant, which is Gus Edge College and Career Network, and it claims that they've coached or mentored 90,000 people. Had you heard of it?
I hadn't heard of it, no. But there are a lot of college counselors out there. From what I understand, there was a quote-unquote legitimate side to his business for many years. And he created what he called this side door into getting admitted into college. The front door, obviously, is getting in based on your merit. The back door is getting in part through the development office, where there's kind of a wink and an agreement to donate large sums of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the side door is fabricating resumes and cheating on standardized tests. And that's what he created.
Do you guys see this? I feel, here's, I got this quote, people don't bribe college officials to help their kids. And the way I interpret that is it's the insecurity of the parents who are defining themselves by their kids getting into, say, Ivy League schools or the University of Chicago, more so than where they should be. Do you find that true?
Ted, do you want to handle that?
Well, you're probably closer to it than I am, Andy. I think, in a way, thank heavens I didn't have to deal with the parents very much. I've heard it from college counselors forever that the parents are the ones who are driving the system crazy, super demanding and unreasonable. I think everyone who's told me that admits it's only a few a year that present those kind of problems, but they always seem to be present. The students seem to be concerned about this, maybe overly concerned, but it seems that the parents are the ones who feel so much is at stake. When I talk to students about this, they're usually a little bit more sensible. I mean, they want the best for themselves, but they barely know what it is that's best for themselves. The parents seem to think they absolutely know that they must have a certain thing, or they've failed their parents.
Ted,
for Highly,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask. Sorry, let me ask Ted, then I want to come back to Andy on how you add value different than Singer. But I've always thought, and I tried to do this with my own kids, that a good approach is try to move your kid off of the pile that's sitting there of 15,000 applicants, and find their little niche. I had two that swam. And we legitimately went to the coach and just, showed them their wares, et cetera. Is that a smart thing, right, to move them off the pile?
Well, I think, sure, if they have special talents, they should be highlighted, and there are legitimate ways to do that. Certainly going to a coach and letting him or her know that your kids could be valuable to the program, and let them convey that information to the admissions office. I mean, there are routes for this, and it seems to work out well and honestly in almost all those cases. In terms of the general advice to move yourself off the pile, I've always reacted not entirely positively to that. I think it means that students try stunts, or they try to, write things that draw attention to themselves in ways that aren't the important ways. The important ways are to be very thoughtful, to be someone who's really interested in the educational enterprise, to let that show. But usually it comes out as some kind of a gimmick or other. But, yeah, moving yourself off the pile is ultimately what you hope will happen. You just kind of hope, and it happens naturally because of your own real qualities and accomplishments.
So, Andy, when you see Singer felt you had to cheat to get in the side door, how do you guys help add value? There's a certain cynicism out there that, rich kids are getting an advantage by all these kind of services, et cetera. Sort of explain how you'd go about it.
Well, it's a multi-year strategy, really, that frankly, in this competitive environment, and as you know, some schools such as Harvard and Stanford are now accepting less than 5% of their applicants. It's a strategy that begins for some of our clients as early as 7th or 8th grade, believe it or not, in which we work with them to make sure that their classes are as rigorous as they can be, because colleges, especially the most selective ones, are looking for kids to be taking challenging courses, to be challenging themselves. Colleges are also all about passion and commitment and leadership and excellence. And so we work with kids to help them identify their strengths and to maximize them. And you talked about your kids being swimmers. It is what's distinctive about a particular student, what separates them from the pack. And we work with them to embrace projects and find projects in the extracurricular arena that really highlight their strengths. We work with them to identify summer programs. There are hundreds of summer programs for high school students at colleges, some of which are not easy to get into. Believe it or not, there's one at MIT that has a 2% acceptance rate. Yes. Now, for the most part, their summer programs are not nearly that competitive, but these are terrific ways to keep the brain active, to dip your toes into college-level work in some cases. And so that's really important as well. And, you know, we work with them to come up with a sort of balanced college list, beginning with schools that are perhaps a bit of a reach and schools then that are where they're in the conversation, and schools finally that are a fairly reasonable bet. You know, we try to do all those things for our students, and we've been in business for 15 years, and we have a track record of honestly and ethically getting our kids into colleges that are right for them. And I think that's the most important thing, and one of the most important lessons that we can draw from the admissions scandal, which is that these parents are trying to push their kids into colleges that are just unsuitable for them. And it's a tragedy for these kids, not to mention those others whose places they may be taking. You know, when parents come to us and kids come to us and say, well, We're ready for the Ivies. We, you know, little Johnny is an Ivy League candidate, and we'll give them an honest evaluation. And if, you know, they're just not in the conversation in terms of academics, in terms of standardized test scores and that kind of thing, most of the time parents and students are fairly accepting of that. And we'll set their sights fairly realistically on a list of colleges that are within their reach. So I think it's really sad that that parents are trying to, as you say, sort of validate their own worth by getting kids through the side door into colleges where they're just not fit to compete.
Andy, do you think that folks that can avail themselves of especially high-quality services like you have versus others that cannot, do they get an unfair advantage? How do you explain that?
Look, the playing field is not level. There's no question about that. And then you have to ask the next question, which is, do you eliminate tutors, if you eliminate college counselors? Do you eliminate swimming coaches? Do you eliminate fielding coaches in softball? Do you eliminate hitting coaches in baseball? And so on and so forth. And where does it stop? Now, it's important to realize that a lot of the problem begins, I think, in public schools, in public high schools. And a lot of our clients come from public high schools because, and this is to me a rather shocking statistic, the ratio of students to counselors at public high schools is 470 students for every one counselor. So it's simply impossible for that counselor, no matter how skilled or well-intentioned, to give those students the attention and guidance they deserve.
All right, I want to finish this segment with Ted, but first, Andy gave me some statistics that back this up. There's 1 million more students applying for essentially the same number of slots, particularly at the most competitive. Kids apply to over 10 schools now because of that common application. 95% at Yale are still meritocratic, so that says the system that is pretty unbiased on the overall in terms of letting folks in. And that schools that were abused by this are just as horrified as all of us are. So that, I don't know whether they were not vetting the athletics departments and things like that well enough. Ted, I want to ask you, what are the major changes in the whole admissions process you've seen over your 20 years at UChicago?
So major changes, some of them, of course, were our own ideas, and some were imposed on us because of changing situations. I mean, if a million more students, probably a million more applications might be the way to most accurately describe it, because students are applying to so many more schools because of the uncertainty. And they're doing it in large part because colleges have become very adept at recruiting, just like any marketers in the world. They've become very good at what they do, and they try very hard and spend a lot of money to do it. And there was a time when we were worried about our existence as numbers of 18-year-olds went down back in, say, the early 80s, and we really geared up the marketing campaigns. At the same time, of course, people became more and more aware of the benefits of college education, and it became to seem more and more necessary, and the prestige of schools seemed to matter, and so people wanted it, and colleges really sought them out, and as a consequence of that, one good consequence is that more people go to college, and they go to college more widely, and they think of more options as possible for them. But it also meant a tremendous confusion in the system. Really too many applications to any given desirable college. I think there are probably too many to be handled well. I think there probably is less time spent really attending to applicants by the colleges in their desire to get bigger numbers. What happened as we sought more applicants as this system developed, what happened is that we were, in many cases, overwhelmed with applications. It made things seem much less reasonable. It's hard to predict who's going to get into any given selective school. So students have to apply to more colleges. So, if they used to apply to, most apply to one, and probably still true, but instead of applying to five or six, which would be a sensible number, I think they're applying to, in some cases up to as many as 20, because they don't know what will happen, or because it's easy, or because their parents can afford it. You're just swept away by the number of people who apply. You, of course, take pride in the fact that you have the capacity to turn so many people down. You don't have as much time to pay real attention. And students are, and families are confused. So I think that is the basic change that has driven a lot of the bad behavior.
Listen to Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We've got more on the college admissions schedule coming right up. Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. In-depth looks at big crime stories. Exclusive interviews only on Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. In-depth looks at big crime stories. Exclusive interviews only on Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We're back with college counseling expert Andy Greenspan and former University of Chicago admissions dean Ted O'Neill. Ted, I want to ask you one more. You kind of glossed over a little bit, but number one, how much individual time does an application get? And secondly, do you look at stuff starting off financially need blind and things like that, or you start building the mosaic right away?
Well, it depends on the school. I mean, at Chicago, we were lucky enough. We had enough resources and directed them in the right directions so that we were, in fact, completely need blind. So we didn't. The mosaic wasn't a mosaic that we designed initially to include low income and high income and so forth. That we just let those chips fall where they may. That's how we began the process. Everyone was equal. We understood that there were inequalities behind what we were seeing that were advantaging certain people, but you know, it wasn't a matter of who had enough money or who didn't. How much time? I would say in my time in the admissions office, which is now going back 8 years ago, we were probably devoting about 12 minutes per reading, and each file was read at least twice and then seen by other people, and many were discussed in committee, so that adds up to a fair number of minutes, and we had 14,000 applications.
Wow.
Now, at the University of Chicago, and this is true at a lot of schools like it, we have 36,000 applications. I've just read in the college newspaper. And how many minutes can be devoted to 36,000, I can't even compute. Now, this means that in many cases, outside readers are being brought in. Certainly, staffs have grown much larger than they used to be in order to not just accommodate this flood of applications, but to encourage more. The desire is always there for more because colleges are judged by their admit rates and by how many applications they get. So it's not that anyone is sitting back and relaxing. And of course, numbers can be much higher. I mean, at USC, it's, what, 60,000? I don't know. I lose track. I mean, it's just a different world in the space of 8 years. But how many minutes can you devote to 60,000 applications?
Well,
it's just...
Jim,
yep.
If I can pick up on what Ted was saying, all the more reason then with all these applications to be able to separate yourself from the pack with a story to tell and a remarkable extracurricular endeavor, a compelling, authentic voice in an essay. All of those things are really critical. Years ago, there was a great book written that I'm sure Ted is familiar with about the admissions process, called The Gatekeepers, in which Wesleyan opened up its doors to Jacques, I think Sternberg was his name, Ted,
right. Yeah.
Who was the education correspondent for the New York Times. And he tells this one story of an admissions officer sitting on his porch, sipping Diet Coke, to stay awake at 11 o'clock at night, getting through his quota of applications that day. And I think of that admissions officer in my mind when we position our students. And I think of him fatigued sitting on his porch. And how can we wake him up? How can we present to him a student with an authentic, compelling, different story to tell. And that's just, to me, so critical, especially when you have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of applications. I mean, here in Florida, for example, the University of Florida received 41,000 applications this year, took 14,000 students. And consider that 20 years ago, it received 14,000 applications. So that's a threefold increase in the number of kids who are applying. So it is very difficult. It is very difficult to fairly evaluate every student who submits an application.
Let me ask you, Andy, at the front end here, because I've interviewed students for Tufts, and I'll get somebody, for instance, who will say, I want to apply early. And, you know, I say early is a great shot to take wherever you decide to go, because it does help you get in. They want folks to commit. And I'm telling you right now, you will not really be able to get into Tufts. And I think you, you know, you're better off not wasting your ammo on a school that you can't get into. How do you go about that front end adjusting folks? And it really comes down to that, you know, you make your own experience wherever you go to college.
Well, where you go to college does not predict where you go in life. That's perhaps the most important thing to understand. And sadly, the parents in this admissions scandal did not understand that and did not appreciate that. I mean, in a lot of cases, we do suggest strongly that our students apply early decision, because if you look at the statistics, you know, for example, at Columbia, they took 5.1% of all applicants this year, but they took 15% early decision. So if you're a reasonable shot at for a school, and it really is your dream school, sure, try to apply early decision. We strongly recommend it. At the same time, you know, it's important to get a clear understanding of where you sit in the bigger picture. And we have a tool called Naviance, which provides a pretty sound analysis of where you are in that picture in terms of your GPA, in terms of your SAT, in terms of your ACT. You know, are you in the conversation for Duke? Or is it a stretch? And if it's a stretch, you probably shouldn't apply early to Duke.
You know, something interesting, just reminded me about Naviance. The Greenwich High School guidance system is overburdened, like you just said, too. But they do provide advice like that. And, you know, I wanted my daughter to consider Tufts because she was on the borderline of all the stats. And with swimming, she could probably get over. And the guidance counselor told her that, but recommended she not apply there because she didn't think it would be the best thing for her personality, which I thought was pretty impressive to say that, basically in the face of her father. And she didn't even apply.
I was an alumni admissions interviewer for Columbia. And it was an enlightening and a frustrating experience for 3 years. I interviewed 45 students in South Florida, and not one got in. And there was one, if I might tell a short story.
Sure.
I'm sure you had this experience when you were, and every college works differently, but when you were an interviewer for Tufts, but we'd have to sort of go back after interviewing the student and write a few paragraphs and give them a sort of 1 to 5 grade and submit it to the admissions office. And there was this one kid I interviewed who was just off the charts amazing. And I went back, and I usually would begin my summary by saying so-and-so is a very nice young man or very nice young lady, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, I said verbatim, I'm going to make this very simple for you. Admit X. He's spectacular. And bottom line, he was denied by Columbia and accepted by Brown, Cornell, and Yale. And he's at Yale currently. But, you know, what's the rhyme or reason? I mean, this is what makes, in part, the admissions process so agonizing. And one of the things I think that we as college counselors do is help to make it a little less agonizing, because we reduce stress for families, and it can be immensely stressful. And I would wager that a lot of these parents were just overcome by anguish and stress. And I'm not at all justifying what they did, but that with a little less stress and a little less anguish, they might have been a little more reasonable.
How do you reduce that anxiety?
Because we provide a roadmap, a series of steps for these kids to follow. We say we're going to work with you on the things that I enumerated before, on making sure that you know, your extracurriculars are reflective of who you are, helping to position you in terms of writing an authentic, compelling essay. We don't write it for you, but we brainstorm on what makes the most sense. And then just very simply working on that essay over the summer so that you're not stressed out in your senior year, you know, in the fall of your senior year, trying to get one of the most important parts of your application done. So it's a question of planning and not panicking.
Ted, let me ask you on that. Can you tell right away when a parent has written the essay? And how important are those essays to you folks?
You can't tell right away. And, of course, you never know. The thing about the essays, which were important to us. I mean, you know, we thought of ourselves in a certain way. I represented a certain kind of college. The intellectual project was most interesting to us, most important to us. And then we found that students who were most impressive were ones who could write with not perfectly, but with real ideas. There was something about their sentences. There was something about the way they wrote that indicated a mind at work. Now, that could be apparent. I think one of the ways we tried to combat the possibility, you can't ever eliminate the possibility, but combat the possibility that parents were doing this or that counselors were unduly influential in the writing of the essays is we had our own essays. We were kind of famous for them. Chicago still does them. They had their own, kind of sometimes kind of wacky, but they were usually very thoughtful and elicited thoughtful responses. Now, with the advent of and success of the Common Application, very nice thing. It helps a lot of kids organize their college applications, but the Common Application really asks a set of very uninteresting, kind of generic questions. Hence, you get a lot of rehearsed and generic answers. Who writes them? In a way, it doesn't matter, because if they're not interesting, it doesn't matter whether the kid wrote them or the parent wrote them or a counselor wrote them. What you need is something that is thoughtful, which is what I always tell students, and no one, some people listen, most don't. They think they have to be gimmicky or say something shocking or new. You know, you have to kind of represent the kind of thinking you do in college in your essay. And when that happens, it comes through. And basically, we thought it wasn't parents when we heard it from students, and of course, when it corresponded to the other things that were being said about the students and their grades and whatever. I mean, the essay was important because the test scores, I think, are utterly unimportant.
Interesting.
I think they're completely coachable. They tell us very little about the way a person thinks.
Interesting.
They tell me nothing about a way a student would behave in my first-year humanities course. You learned more, if you could, and you couldn't always, because sometimes there was a remove between you and the student because of intervening things, but you really wanted to hear it in their essays. You wanted to hear teachers say certain things that were important to us. And, you know, of course, you wanted to see a transcript that represented good hard work over time and some daring choices.
I always kind of had the impression that on the SATs, for instance, they knew if you went to Greenwich High School here that you'd probably been to like 15 prep courses. And if you're maybe in an inner city or someplace like Nebraska that doesn't focus on it as much, so that you guys actually adjust the scores. A 1,400 at one place is different than a 1,400 from another.
Yeah, you tacitly do, and that may be completely unfair because you'd hear about kids from counselors from a place like Greenwich who'd say, and you know, he didn't even go to be counseled. You know, he did this cold, and I congratulate him for it. And, you'd hear that, but you these days, of course, it's not just Greenwich, it's pretty much the world.
Yeah.
So coaching is as much a part of the testing scene as anything.
Jim, in addition to the personal essay, which is I think what we've been discussing, Common App has 7 prompts, you choose one of them and write a personal essay. There are all these supplemental essays that colleges will ask students to write, and some are pretty basic, sort of meat and potatoes questions, like BU or NYU might ask why BU or why NYU, but your alma mater, Tufts, is somewhat notorious for its quirky questions. A few years ago, one of them was, Kermit the Frog says it's not easy being green. Discuss. So, when you talk about stress and you have students applying to 10 colleges, they're not just writing the personal essay, but then they're writing these little supplemental essays. So in total, they may be writing 20 essays, which is why it's important to get started in the process as early as possible.
Listen to Forensic Talk with Jim Hill. We've got our final segment coming up next. We've got college admissions experts, Ted O'Neill from University of Chicago, Andy Greenspan from International College Consulting. And Andy, first off, I wanted to ask you, I think in the notes you sent me that you think the process should be more transparent. What do you mean by that?
Well, why did that kid get denied by Columbia and accepted by Brown, Cornell, and Yale? Mm-hmm. We don't know. When I was a documentary producer, I approached 20 colleges and spoke with a number of deans of admission and asked if we could get inside the process for a year, just as Jacques Sternberg had done at Wesleyan in a book. And could we follow, for example, a couple of admissions officers mm-hmm. and follow 5 or 6 students who would have signed off on, allowing their cases to be sort of publicly discussed and aired? And the answer from all of them was no. So I think we'd have, in certain cases, an easier time finding out what was going inside. Going on inside the walls of the Kremlin than inside the walls of some of the most selective colleges.
Ted, on the selectivity and the pressure, there seems to be, you hear all these stories about sleep deprivation, anxiety, depression, even suicide coming out of colleges now once these kids are in. Do you worry about the whole process creating sort of a monster?
most students don't apply to selective colleges. So as a kind of notion of some kind of public health menace, mm-hmm. most students aren't in the game. And then the students who are applying to selective colleges, most are sensible. They handle their lives well. They get enough sleep. They eat well. Their parents encourage them. And there are people who are who worry too much about it and suffer for it. Undoubtedly true, and I feel for them. And I wish that weren't the case. And I understand why the way colleges behave, certainly the way parents behave, puts undue pressure on certain kids, on a lot of kids, and certain kids don't respond to it well.
Ted, do you worry about the amount of debt that kids are accumulating with, by the time they're through with school? And Andy, is that part of your process?
Do I think that a higher education is worth a lot? Yes. Do I think it should be free? No. I think it's probably worth paying for it, insofar as you can. I think most students from most selective colleges don't leave with an impossible amount of debt, who are over-borrowing in order to support families or something like that. Most students have a reasonable amount of debt, and they're getting something very good for it. So I wish colleges weren't as expensive as they are, but I know why they're as expensive as they are, and I think they're worth a lot.
So, Andy, do you help incorporate the financial evaluation piece of it in your analysis, your help?
Generally, no. We can certainly point families in the direction of scholarships and scholarship websites and financial aid opportunities, but our emphasis is really on the admission side rather than on the financial side.
Let me ask you this. Some students really don't belong in college, or it's not the best fit. They might be better off in a vocational school, a pre-professional school, something along those lines. What do you tell those folks? Or are your guys just interested in getting into the best?
A good question. I mean, we deal with all sorts of aspirations, from the Ivies to a community college. And our aim is to find best fit for students. We generally don't have students who are coming to us for vocational school, but we try to point students in the direction of colleges that are most suitable for them. And for the most part, unlike the families in the college admissions scandal, mm-hmm. Families are receptive to that advice. Sometimes it's an initial bit of a cold shower and understanding that, that no, Georgetown is not a possibility. But in the end, where is your student? Where is your child going to be happiest? If I could tell a brief story, I remember sitting in on a class at an Ivy about 20 years ago, and it was the kind of class that Ted would love because it was a philosophy class in which they were discussing Kant and Hegel around a seminar table, and everyone was acquitting himself or herself brilliantly except for this one kid. And who just seemed totally overmatched. And I instantly felt terrible for that kid and wondered how and why he had gotten in. I think the point is to find the school that works best for your child, and that's what we try to do.
All right, as we finish up, you guys are each on opposite sides of this process. Is there one thing each of you would like to see changed that would make everything better there?
Well, there are actually a few things. I've already been critical of the tests, which I continue to think of as a tremendous waste of time and money, and puts attention on the wrong thing. So I think testing is broken. But I think probably the colleges are just simply at fault for ginning up this business to such a degree that it's a matter of how how many people we can turn down, and our reputation rests on that. I think somehow,
interesting,
you know, the ratings were a problem from the beginning. Not that they'll ever go away, but the U.S. News and World Report is at fault for a lot of this. But colleges, which should know better, succumbing to that kind of thing, are probably the real problems in all this.
Andy?
I mean, I would really second what Ted says. And, you know, as a former journalist, I would just like to see colleges become more transparent about their processes. I just think that's really important because of the unpredictability of them. So I think that ultimately would be something, but I don't think, frankly, that will happen. You know, as I mentioned, my own experience in trying to gain access inside those processes was met with a big, gee, that's an interesting idea, but no thank you. And I just found that to be really sad.
All right, it's been a great quick hour. Andy, what's your website? How can folks contact you?
It's internationalcollegecounselors.com, and it's andy@internationalcollegecounselors.com.
All right, I want to thank Andy Greenspan of International College Counseling, and we wish Ted O'Neill the best in his next part of his career there at University of Chicago after 27 years in the admissions office. This has been Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll see everybody next Monday night with another edition.